Hello, everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the World of War Crimes. Once again, I am Jeremy Leyland, your host, and I know it's been 2 weeks since I recorded my last episode. I think I'm going to space it out like this from here on out so that way I get more time to do research, so that way I'm not rushing myself. So that's might be the plan moving forward. I hope that everybody understands. This way I can get better topics. I wouldn't say better, but, you know, more thorough topics. I have next week's or the next topic ready, but at least this way I can get topics ready for research. So I do have a topic now, which, like I said, I would. I don't believe in this podcast I've spoken about any Russian war criminals. So we're going to dabble in the Soviet Union for a bit. I'm pretty sure that I won't get in trouble with the Russian government, even though it is in a state of war. But let's hope not. And also because they consider this person treasonous. So that's why I'm pretty sure I'm safe with talking about this particular individual. So now on with the show. Our villain, Andrei Andreevich Vlasov, was born on September 14th, 1901 in Lomachino in the Russian Empire. Apparently that's over by Nizhny Novgorod, or Gorky, as some people know it as. In his youth, he was a student at a Russian Orthodox seminary where he studied the divinity, and then he would move on to agriculture sciences later on. It seems to be a common theme with a lot of these revolutionary leaders to go into the church, study, and then kind of get bored with it. That's what my assumption would be. He would study this until the Russian Revolution, the big one, not 1905, but, you know, because obviously being four in 1905, he wouldn't have been able to study. So 1917 is when the revolution starts, and he stopped studying right around that time. In 1919, he was either drafted or joined willingly into the Red Army and would fight in Ukraine, Crimea, and the Caucasus during the Russian Civil War, eventually becoming an officer. The reason I said he either joined or drafted was because the information I was reading into stated that he did one or the other, so that's why I put it in there. Although he is successful in the army, he doesn't actually join the Communist Party until 1930. What's also odd to me is that I couldn't find anything on him between, say, 1922, the end of the war, and then 1930, so 8 years. Apparently, I don't know if this life, part of his life, wasn't important or he just wasn't doing a whole lot. And then the same thing happens between 1930 and 1938. So if anybody has anything about this man for those 16 years, that would be super, because it feels like, you know, Soviets either kind of hid the information or it's just not there. So anyways, in 1938, he is sent to China to be an advisor to Chiang Kai-shek. He would remain in China until November of 1939. So after the war starts in Europe, he's still there in China. Also, he is in Shaanxi between February and May of 1939 as a local advisor to Yan Xishan. I assume that's the governor or military commander in that area. Remember, China is at war, civil war, and also against the Japanese. So he is there helping the Kuomintang. He would also be part of the Soviet military mission under General Alexander Cherepanov. After this, in 1940, he becomes the commander of the 99th Rifle Division. And 6 months later, his unit, after inspection from Marshal Semyon Timoshenko, would be labeled as one of the best divisions in the Red Army. So whatever he was doing there earned him some high praises from top brass back in Moscow, because as we know, Timoshenko was one of Stalin's leading generals. Obviously before the war, he was a kind of a big shot kind of guy. Now, June 1941, war breaks out, Germany invades the Soviet Union. 1 month in, and he's in command of the 37th Army at the Battle of Kiev from July 7th to September 26th. During this, his army faced encirclement, but somehow it escaped. Afterwards, he would be called to assist in the defense of Moscow, as the Germans had made it there during the fall. During his time there, he retook the town of Sonechogorsk, I hope I said that right, which is 65 kilometers northwest of Moscow, which reestablished the connection between Moscow and the besieged city of Leningrad. Now, Leningrad is still under siege, but at least this way the Russians have a connected front. For those who are not aware of how much 65 kilometers are, remember, kilometers are a little bit longer than miles. So you're looking at, say, in between like 52 and 55 miles from Moscow. So they're not far from Moscow to begin with. For his efforts for taking the town, he was ordered the Order of the Red Banner on January 24th, 1942. This medal was the first Soviet military decoration made during the Civil War and would later become the highest medal one could achieve for military service. After this, he would take command of the 2nd Shock Army at Volkhov after relieving its commander, Lieutenant General Klykov, during their own encirclement. He would then be ordered to lift the siege that currently held the city of Leningrad. And remember, this is still January. Beginning on January 7th, 1942, his army spearheads what would become the Lyuban offensive. He proceeded to cross the Volkhov River and broke the German 18th Army lines, penetrating as deep as 74 kilometers. So again, about 65, 66 miles. However, the armies that were supporting him failed to capitalize on his gains, and he became stranded deep behind German lines. He was refused permission to retreat. And of course, this is kind of a big deal. No step back. So, yeah, he was not allowed to retreat at this time until May, so 5 months later. By this time, it was too late. Since his army was too weak to move or go back, they made an attempt. They would, however, be eventually surrounded and subsequently eliminated during their attempted breakout from a little place called Miasnoy Bar. I believe it's a – I looked it up. And it's a very small area, like just east, northeast of Leningrad. Correct me if I'm wrong, but yeah, he was on his way, but yeah, he got surrounded and they got routed. During the attempted breakout, he was offered an escape via plane on July 2nd, 1942, but he refused. He would hide in occupied territory for 10 days before he was exposed by a local farmer. What the Germans did is they went out on patrol because they heard reports of partisans operating in the area. And when they went into the town, they went up to the farmhouse, and lo and behold, there was two people, partisans, in the house. One of them was Vlasov. So they realized it was a kind of a big deal, and so they took him to, you know, a commanding officer in the area, and yeah. So he would be captured on July 12th in a town, like I said, after the patrol was sent to check on partisans. It is here that Vlasov enters captivity. He would be interrogated by German commanders about his army and details about the surrounding areas. Then he would be imprisoned at Vinnytsia, which at the time is in occupied Ukraine. While in prison, he met Captain Wilfred Strick Strickfeldt. Strick Strickfeldt had been part of the White Russian movement during the Russian Civil War, and he was attempting to create a Russian liberation movement where he had hoped to recruit Vlasov in his plight against Stalin and, of course, Bolshevism. At first, Vlasov refused the offer. So far, so good, right? When he finally did accept the offer, he was taken to Berlin under the control of the Wehrmacht propaganda department, something I did not know existed, to be honest. I've been studying World War II for God knows how long, and I never knew that the army propaganda department existed. I knew that other propaganda entities existed, just not this one. This was a department of the Wehrmacht and the Waffen-SS that was tasked with dissemination and propaganda to the troops and, of course, to the home population of troops and so on and so forth, the morale and such. Here, under their very watchful eye, Vlasov and other Soviet officers drafted plans for Russian provisional government and the recruitment of a Russian liberation army under Russian officer control. Unofficially, the idea of the Committee for the Liberation of the Peoples of Russia was created with this hope in mind. In spring 1943, he wrote an anti-Bolshevist leaflet, the Smolensk Proclamation, which was distributed by the millions in Soviet-held territory, attempting to promote the dissolution and angst amongst Soviet troops to get them to surrender and fight against their leaders and such. In March, he would also pen an open letter, why I have taken the struggle against Bolshevism. Of course, while in 1943, the ROA didn't exist, and that's the acronym for the Russian Liberation Army. I read what it was in Russian, but I'm not even going to try and say what it is because I don't speak Russian. So, no, it's just the ROA. Although many of its patches were distributed to Russian troops who were serving in the Wehrmacht in the East, so they'd be on their shoulder, you know, that way kind of like signifying that they were Russian troops. He would make trips into German-occupied territory, notably in a town called Pskov, which is northwest Russia, south of Leningrad. It's kind of close to the Estonian border, if you want to look it up on a map. Here, he made a speech labeling the Germans as guests, which, to the higher German higher-ups, including Hitler, was kind of humiliating, because to them, they were not guests. They were occupiers, and they meant to take the territory. Afterwards, he was placed on house arrest and threatened to be turned over to the Gestapo. However, he threatened to return to the POW camp and threatened to resign his post. So, you know, give and take, I suppose, right? It is known that Vlasov's emissary, so his cronies, his guys working for him, would lecture POWs throughout occupied territories and tell them that the Communist Party had abandoned them. They were labeled as traitors, which was true, and that escaping was pointless. They also stated that if the Soviets won, the gulags in Siberia awaited them, which meant almost certain death for all of them, no matter, because, you know, you surrender, so you are no longer viable troops. Finally, in November of 1944, with the backing of Heinrich Himmler, the ROA was finally allowed to be created through what was called the Prague Manifesto, under the command of Vlasov. The manifesto itself sounded very Western in nature, as it guaranteed the freedom of speech, press, religion, and assembly, but this was kind of done in order to be in good graces of the Western democracies, you know, hopefully if Germany lost, then the West would allow them to continue to fight against the Russians and liberate them for a democratic, you know, nation. That was their hope. What it neglected, which is kind of interesting, and also to the ire of their German masters, was the lack of any anti-Semitic rhetoric or other racial laws that would have coincided with German law that wasn't in the Russian proclamation. The committee was seen also as a political arm of the ROA. So before I continue with the story of the ROA, I think it's important to address the fact that many Russians, Lithuanians, Ukrainians, and other Eastern Europeans served in the Wehrmacht before 1943. They were called Hilfswillige, or Hiwis. These Hiwis were most always in the rear of the lines doing non-combat jobs. Interestingly enough, it was thought that 25% of the 6th Army at Stalingrad were Hiwis. Of course, if you were one of these and you were caught by the Russian army, you were absolutely, most likely, executed without even a second thought. Because why were you in their army? And two, why would you betray your country to fight for these, you know, these dogs, if you would? By 1943, several hundred thousand troops were serving in the German army to some capacity. However, by summer, many of these units were disbanded for mutinous activities and also being unreliable. After the Germans reevaluated their purpose, basically they were like, what do we do with these people now that we might be losing this war? Many of those units were sent west because there was no ties to the area and they could defend them because, you know, Russians have no ties to the French, or, you know, Ukrainians, same thing. They're just defending an area because that's what they're told to do. However, many of them would surrender on the landing of D-Day to the Allies. But referring back to the Soviet reaction towards their own troops, fate did not necessarily await them that was good. So, with the creation of the committee, followed the ROA. The ROA's first division would see combat, so there was an attempt to make three divisions, but only one was fully mobilized for combat, and it would see action on February 11th, 1945. So a bit late to make a difference in the war, and they would fight on the Oder River, which is the border now between Germany and Poland. However, they were soon overwhelmed and would make a retreat towards Prague and German-held Bohemia. They actually fought for 3 days. So, I mean, kudos to them for holding out for as long as they did against, you know, superior and or overwhelming odds fighting the Russians. They did make it to Prague in time for the Prague uprising, which began on May 5th. I think they arrived there that day. And that would be May 5th, 1945. At first, they decided to not get involved with the uprisings just because they didn't want to, you know, upset the Germans. However, given their treatment against the Germans, or, you know, by the Germans, they actually changed their mind. And that was, he received a quest from his commanding officer, General Sergei Bunyachenko. And at first, Vlasov was hesitant, but then he changed his mind. And so the ROA began opening fire on the Wehrmacht in the east of Prague. In the beginning, they were able to disarm right around estimated 10,000 Germans. So good job them. However, a lot of people will say that this was to gain favor with the West or even the approaching Russians, which were coming from their rear. However, the next day, May 6th, the Czechs realized that they were in the Soviet side of the demarcation line, which was at the Czech border. So they denounced the ROA, as they could not support them since they were a treasonous military unit, according to the Soviet Union. So what they did was they began to arrest ROA soldiers in order to turn them into the Red Army for eventual trial and or just outright execution. On May 7th, ROA soldiers had slowed the German advance into the city, but with the news that the Russians were coming and the Czechs not necessarily supporting their efforts, they had to try and retreat towards American lines because they believed the Americans would give them more of an, like a more of a friendly welcome than obviously the Russians. So they left Prague. After they left, though, the Germans were able to temporarily retake the city. Obviously not very long because the Russians were coming. The ROA and whatnot, they would make it to Pilsen, which is in the western part of the country, where many of them would be taken into custody by the 44th Infantry Division. But upon their capture, they were forcefully turned over to the Red Army for their sentencing. And I say that loosely because, again, it was a very most likely a quick trial and or execution. Depending on their rank, they were either sent to a gulag or executed. So congrats on the sentence that awaited you. Vlasov was captured on May 9th, trying to surrender to American troops. When they refused his surrender, he was dragged out of his car by Soviet officers, put on a tank, and sent back to Soviet 13th Army headquarters in occupied Dresden, Germany. And the occupying commander there was Marshal Ivan Konev. So he's kind of a big deal in the Russian army at this point. From there, he was immediately sent by train back to Moscow and imprisoned at Lubyanka, which most people watching any kind of movie or anything know what Lubyanka is. Not a good place. Not to waste time, on July 30th, his trial begins, where he was sentenced to death with 11 other officers, most likely for treason and other offenses possibly related to the failure of the Luban offensive. And I'll cover that in just a second, why that kind of is a deal. 2 days later, 2 days later, August 1st, he was executed by hanging. But this isn't the end of his story. So first off, I would absolutely like to point out that by becoming a turncoat on your country is an act treason. It's all its own. Think America, Benedict Arnold. He's kind of our turncoat, you know, trying to turn over West Point to the British and hopefully turning the tide of the war in their favor. We know about that. More recently with World War II, Vidkun Quisling, he's another one. And I did an episode on him earlier, so if you want to take a gander, go ahead. However, Soviet show trials were absolutely a thing, and Stalin did his damnedest to pin blame on others when it absolutely should have just been stayed with himself. For example, the Luban offensive. So this is why it gets a little hairy with that. While Vlasov was able to gain much ground during the offensive, poor planning was not able to maintain the ground kept and also did not allow for retreat, which directly led to his capture. So in this regard, you can blame Stalin and the Stavka for, you know, the failure that happened trying to retake the city. It doesn't change his status that he turned against the Soviet Union after his capture, but it does open the door for interesting conversation. Just saying, you know, Stalin's poor planning led to his capture. I would say it's simple as that, but I'm pretty sure I would get kind of, you know, flack for that, I suppose. After his death, though, it seems that his memory lives on, not in Russia, but in New York. In the United States. at the Novo Dievo or Divievo convent in Nenuet, New York, they have a small memorial for Vlasov and the ROA. On the anniversary of his execution and the Sunday following the Orthodox Easter, they hold a memorial service for these individuals. Lastly, and kind of odd, in 2019, a neighborhood in the city of Prague, there is a potential statue, a memorial that's being proposed for the defense of Prague during the uprising of 1945 that commemorates the ROA for their efforts in the fighting. Because Vlasov is a traitor in Russian eyes, this doesn't sit well with the Russian government. However, the mayor of this little town or this neighborhood basically just said he doesn't care. The Russian government actually sent him a letter that said, don't do this. You know, he's a traitor. But this mayor replied and said, whatever, basically. So I was like, okay, cool. But yeah, that was the proposal, you know, 5 years ago. And I haven't seen any updates. Maybe the statue's already built. So I'd have to double check on that one. So that is the story of Andrei Vlasov, Russian collaborator. Simple, simple, right? Next time, I actually wrote here that I don't have a topic, but I actually do. This time we're going to Japan because, you know, there's a ton of Japanese collaborators, but I don't think I've done aside from Tokyo Rose. It is Matsui, so hopefully some folks don't really know a lot about him, but we're going to talk about him. Either way, I have another podcast. It's called Beyond the Textbooks. Take a listen if you want. It's about the lighter side of history, because as we know, World of War Crimes is not for the faint of heart. But I'm going to try and find another one that's kind of dark, just because it's been a while since we've kind of delved into those stories. I am on Spotify, iHeartRadio, Apple. I also have a webpage. It is my name, Jeremy Leyland, at Weebly.com. Basically, you can find both my podcasts on that page. That way you just have one link to both. And then, of course, if you want to leave comments, reviews, you can leave them on Spotify, Apple, that kind of stuff. But yeah, I just want to say thank you, everybody, for listening. And hopefully you have a lovely Monday. And as you can tell, it's a different background. I'm in my living room this time instead of my office because I wanted a more comfy spot. But yeah, anyway, you guys have a lovely, lovely Monday. And until next time.